Oh, I'm in.
You can do that for us.
Yep, no problem. Welcome, everyone, to the April 28, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We got a few things here just for, I guess we took the grass seed bills off, didn't we?
Yep.
Good. So we don't have that. Let's see, the first bill, I promised we'd get this out of the way, Representative is here. So we'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2743.
But my partner...
Did you lose him?
You have to open the public hearing.
I did. Both.
You can open both?
Mm-hmm. So...
What the hell is going on with my computer?
Had to get an apple.
We've got the team.
I'm a liberal progressive
for you.
At home?
That's Representative.
All
he isn't looking for me, I'm looking for him.
This is a state computer, so.
You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. This is the very best kind of bill, the kind of bill someone brings to you and says, we just need a little fix here. And it almost went through last time, and here we are back again. And this bill basically allows podiatrists to be added to the list for workers' comp physicians. And I'm going to let Tom do all the heavy lifting here and fill in the blanks, and hopefully I didn't leave out anything super important. But he's the one to credit here with your questions. So I hope that you will be positive in your consideration.
My understanding is this one came out of the House with a 60-0 vote?
Yes, it was. That's the only way.
Pretty controversial over there?
Yes. All the House members approved.
I bet we can approve it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. One quick correction. It actually came out of the House 58-0. I'm still upset that two of the members were excused that day, so I didn't get a 60-0. But as Representative Boone said, this seeks to return podiatrists as attending physicians within workers' comp. When the workers' comp reforms were done in 1990, they didn't have someone representing them and had gotten left out, and by all indications it was an inadvertent oversight, but once it was in, they didn't want to make changes for time being. Now 20 years later, I think it's time to make some changes. Doctors of podiatric medicine have a similar degree to MD-DO, 4 years postgraduate, full prescription, full surgery. They just have a specific scope of practice on a specific part of the body. This would just allow them to treat the patients rather than have to refer them back to an MD back and forth, which costs the system money and slows down treatment. This has been approved by MLAC. I want to acknowledge the staff there for all their efforts in trying to help me figure out the best way to do this. They did a study a few years ago that showed that this was an area that was being underutilized. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Not off easy. Thank you. We'll let you go back to work.
Very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody? This is all I had signed up on 2743. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify?
Steve Jefferson.
Okay. On 2743. Seeing none, we will. I guess we're in a work session, so the chair would move House Bill 2743 to. Can we do that? We take the fiscal. That's what we do.
Thanks.
Yep.
To, House, huh?
Yep. To the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none. 2743 is passed to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry that one?
I'd love to.
You'd like to?
It's just exciting.
Well, how wonderful.
Okay.
Okay, so I will close the, I don't think I closed the public hearing, so we'll close the public hearing on 2743 and the work session in case I didn't. We will now go back to the top and open public hearing on House Bill 2092.
Richard. Senate Bill 2092 modifies the manner in which a notice of compliance is made available to subject employers under the workers' compensation system. There is also a dash 2 amendment which allows a licensed nurse practitioner who is not a member of a managed care organization to provide commensurable medical services for 180 days instead of 90 days from the first visit. There's both no revenue on the bill and the amendment and no fiscal on the bill and on the amendment.
Okay. John, you and whoever else from MLAC?
Yes, boss.
Whoever wants to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services. With me today is Sherry Sundstrom and Tracy Brill, who are members of the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. I'm very honored to be here today with them and in front of you as well. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 2092A. The department regularly evaluates the laws and processes so we can find opportunities to streamline and improve outcomes in workers' compensation for workers and employers. This bill makes three changes to the workers' compensation law to try to reduce burden to employers, better protect workers, and simplify regulations. We want to provide more flexibility, first of all, to employers in their notice of compliance. The law requires the department to furnish employers a printed notice, and employers must display that notice in a conspicuous manner in their workplaces. This bill removes the requirement that we, the department, furnish a printed compliance notice. Instead, it will allow us to work with stakeholders and our customers to develop more flexible and efficient ways to provide the notice. For example, downloadable documents off the Internet. It doesn't change the content of the notice. Employers would still be required to make the information available to their workers. The second thing this bill does is deletes the licensing board review as part of a determination of what medical services are compensable under workers' compensation. That is, we are sometimes asked whether insurers or self-insured employers must pay for certain services. Under the law, medical services that are determined to be unscientific, unproven, outmoded, or experimental are not compensable. In other words, there's no required payment for those services. The department is currently required by the law to seek the advice of the Workers' Compensation Medical Advisory Committee, made up of worker representatives, employers, and mostly medical professionals with extensive experience in treating workers' compensation injuries. The law also requires that we seek the advice of professional licensing boards. Licensing boards, however, don't evaluate medical treatments to determine whether insurers should be required to pay for them. In practice, licensing boards have not responded to requests for their input on medical treatment rules. So this bill removes the requirement that DCBS specifically consult with licensing boards when determining whether a medical treatment is unscientific, unproven, outmoded, or experimental. The department will continue to consult the medical experts on the medical advisory committee as well as the range of stakeholders interested in the issue. And we would welcome and consider any input from the licensing board that they choose to provide, and that's also in the bill. Finally, this bill clarifies a vocational assistance training program appeal issue. In 2009, HB 2195 was passed, which made a number of changes to vocational assistance laws for injured workers. One of the changes allowed insurers to voluntarily extend wage replacement benefits to workers in training programs without requiring DCBS approval or oversight by the regulator. And that was to streamline the process and eliminate the need to involve DCBS when the worker and the insurer are already in agreement about an extension on training. However, we inadvertently removed our own ability to take an action when the worker appeals the insurer's decision about the duration of the wage replacement benefit provided during the worker's training program. This bill simply reinstates the department's authority to resolve these disputes if a worker requests an appeal. On all three of these issues, MLAC voted to support this bill in the A engrossed form, and I wanted to answer any questions I could on this part of the bill, although I also understand that you're considering dash A2 amendments. And these amendments would, as I understand, will expand duration of treatment provided by nurse practitioners without requiring them to refer the worker to another attending physician, such as an MD or a DO. The Management Labor Advisory Committee reviewed the same concept in the form of House Bill 3212. MLAC did not vote to approve the bill. And to my right are MLAC members here to speak to you as to why they took that position that they did.
Chair Beyer, my name is Sherry Sundstrom, and I'm with Hoffman Construction, and I'm in the co-management chair for the MLAC committee. As you know, the MLAC is comprised of five management members and five labor members. We vet out bills and that come before us, and Tracy is going to speak specific to the nurse practitioner portion of this bill. But I want to provide a little bit of background. I understand that most of you are very well aware of what MLAC does, but I just want to reiterate what we're here for and what we do and what we do as a resource for you all. Members of the MLAC are committed to a common set of values for a workers' compensation system, balance and fairness, and benefits are commensurate with the severity of an injury, an affordable system that contributes to a healthy Oregon business climate, efficiency, a stable system encourages consistency but is flexible enough to change when necessary. And so anything that does come before us or anything that we view as being something that needs to be addressed, we do so. And throughout the years, we've looked at several different areas, things that perhaps that you have brought before us. Most recent was the death benefit study. We've also looked at permanent partial disability awards and many, many other items where we keep a pulse point on the system. And I want to encourage you as you listen to Tracy to recognize we spend a great deal of time on these various items, and we make sure that whatever we're providing you with is the best information that we have available to us, and hope that you will take that into consideration today. Tracy.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer. My name is Tracy Burrell. I'm a lieutenant with the fire department, and when I'm not at work, I'm volunteering with the MLAC subcommittee. I represent labor. And today I'd like to just talk to you about the Dash 2 amendment. And the Dash 2 amendment came to us many months ago as a separate bill. It was House Bill 3212. And we spent a significant amount of time reviewing House Bill 3212. And we reviewed this both in a subcommittee and in our full committee. And there was many, many discussions, many opponents and proponents that presented their positions with us. During this time, we understood that the bill was chiefly proposed to increase access to care, which as a labor representative is something I really want to see happen. MLAC operates, though, from the perspective that ideas should have the support of the majority of management and the majority of labor. And in going through this process and reviewing all the material that was presented to us, we came to a vote, and in our vote, we determined that we would not pass the bill as it was proposed, but that we would recommend it for a subcommittee for further review. And this is something that we've done quite commonly. We've done it to improve access to care with multiple providers, as you heard from the podiatrist that was up here earlier. In 2005, we passed a bill that would improve workers' access to multiple providers. So we have a history of doing this, and in recent years, we've taken on significant subjects from death benefits and partial disability benefits, and we've moved legislation that, as I mentioned, will improve that access and improve those benefits. We're not dismissing this idea at all. We're asking that you give us a chance to look at it in a wider and a broader scope, to include other practitioners in our review, and to come before you again with a bill that takes in all these ideas. The subcommittee has already started, and we welcome anybody to come and participate in our discussions. I appreciate your time this afternoon, and I'm willing to answer any of your questions.
Can you share what was the vote?
The vote was, there's five members from management and five members from labor. The vote was, all five members from management voted against House Bill 3212, and one member of labor also voted against House Bill 3212, and four members of labor voted for House Bill 3212. And just to clarify that we are a very collaborative group, I want to let you know that Sherry and I sat on opposite sides of the fence on this vote, but I'm here in support of MLAC and in support of the process and recognize that we are quite able to review this and bring before you something that includes all practitioners.
I have to admit, I'm a little confused by it, because particularly if you look at the rural areas, one of the big problems we're having as a state is a lack of access to primary care docs. And one of the movements this legislature is doing is to move more to mid-level practitioners and more of a heavy reliance on nurse practitioners and physician assistants. So I'm a little confused, because I would think it would be a move to cheaper care rather than more expensive care.
Well, and one of the things that came up, because that's what, you know, I think we all went into this, and Kathy Nishimoto, who was our chair for this subcommittee, she utilizes alternative practitioners for her care, like nurse practitioners. And we all went into this as being an access issue. That was what was brought before our committee, was this is an access issue. This will provide more access to injured workers. But as all the statistics panned out, only 0.5% of the billings for medical providers in the system are related to nurse practitioners, very similar to what it was in 2005 when we gave them the 90 days, the original 90 days. Also what proved up, and I think there may be, I'm not sure if there's going to be anybody else testifying to this, but the MCOs brought to us that they can define how long a nurse practitioner will treat within the managed care organizations, which many employers and many carriers participate in. We also found out that the adjusters, Safe Corporation, provided to us information that they have within their guidelines, within their adjusters can make a decision to extend the care for nurse practitioners. So, you know, it's brought as an access issue and a continuity of care issue. And yet, if the question is asked, nobody's going to turn down an injured worker to have the additional care. I know our adjuster would not do that. And we are insured through a carrier in the state of Oregon. And, you know, and our workers through the MCO, they do have access to providers. And Hoffman Construction, we're throughout the state. So that is a concern to us. And when this was brought as an access issue, it became quite apparent that it's not just about nurse practitioners. This stretches far and wide. And what we need to do to be in ready for 2014 when healthcare hits us is to make sure that we make workers' comp the most happy place for providers to treat in, because we want to make sure that we are getting workers to providers. So, and Kathy Nishimoto, she also met with nurse practitioners in her area. She met with 6 of them. And many of them didn't even know that they could treat beyond 30 or 60 days, let alone the 90 days. And many of them did not want to do the care because workers' comp is such a pain of the area to practice in. So one of the things that we've already met on this subcommittee, we're going to look at why is workers' comp not a desirable area to treat in? Because it's not just about getting access to a nurse practitioner. I think that people have access to the care providers if the care providers are willing to treat within the workers' compensation system. And I think that 0.5% is very telling if we haven't changed the billings for nurse practitioners in the 6 years that they've been allowed to treat within the system.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, I have 2 others signed up, Brian DeLashment and Teresa Russell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Brian DeLashment representing the Oregon Nurses Association. With me, I have Teresa Russell, a nurse practitioner from Eastern Oregon, and she'll testify when I get done. Actually, I have a couple comments and then a sheet that's being passed around. We'll give you a little history of nurse practitioners and workers' comp. I've been with the Oregon Nurses Association since 1979. I started when I was 14 years old. Representative Atkinson is giving me the eyeball there. One of the first issues I ran into was nurse practitioners and the ability to practice in the state of Oregon. During that session, the legislature overwhelmingly approved independent practice for nurse practitioners and independent billing for nurse practitioners in the state. We were, at the time, considered probably the most progressive state on independent practice of nurse practitioners, and we're very proud of that. Since that time, there's been no other issue that I've run into historically in my 30-plus years in the Capitol building that has taken more of my time than the nurse practitioner and workers' comp issue. If I were to bring the files from my office, it would be about 2.5 to 3 feet high. Let me give you the history from that sheet, and I'll go back to a couple other notes. In the late 70s and early 80s, nurse practitioners were full providers within the workers' comp system. There was no time limits on their practice. They were considered exactly the same as MDs. Shortly thereafter, in the mid-80s, there was an interpretation of the existing statute. The existing statute talked about workers' comp providers being practitioners of the healing arts. There was a ruling then that because nurse practitioners were not in existence when that statute was written, it couldn't be interpreted that nurse practitioners were practicing the healing arts, even though we believed it was very clear. The next session, the law was clarified, and nurse practitioners were fully back in to the workers' comp system as full providers. No time limits on time, no number of visits. In the 1990s, then Mahoney Hall, resulted in nurse practitioners only being able to do 12 visits or 30 days. And I'll be really frank with you, all MD or non-MD providers were basically lumped out of that system and given the 30 days or 12 visit limits. And the C word comes to mind. I wrote it on my history there, but there were abuses by a particular provider group that were running some costs up in the system. In 2003, House Bill 2828 passed 59-1 and 19-9, and the governor vetoed that bill based upon it not getting MLOC approval, the same situation we're in today. That would have reversed and gone back to a no time limit on nurse practitioners practicing in the state. Obviously, the legislature overwhelmingly approved that concept, even though MLAC, as they have done at this point, has failed to act in support. That very same session, in 2003, House Bill 6639 passed 51-0 and 27-0 after MLAC and ONA, with a hammer from the governor. Governor brought the parties together and said, I want this worked out. And as a result, it was 90 days, and we have the current law of 90 days. Let me be real frank. 90 days was very arbitrary at the time, and you'll hear the reason why it's not fully working at this point. And you've heard some testimony that's not a large group of folks that are being seen or billings by nurse practitioners. Let me assure you that if you're that particular individual that's injured and you're an enterprise or you're in Lincoln City or you're in Coos Bay and you have absolutely no access to another provider, it's very important to you. If you have to drive 100 miles or 150 miles when you're referred to an MD because the nurse practitioner can no longer see you, they have to refer you on. It is very important to them, and that's why this bill is in front of you. In 2005-2006, DCPS, the Workers' Comp Division, did a study and found no issues with nurse practitioners doing workers' comp, and it increased access. Workers' Comp Division endorsed in 2007 reauthorization of the 90-day time limit set 4 years prior. So part of that agreement in 2003 was the four-year sunset. They do a study. That study came back. It's very, very clear that there was no downside to nurse practitioners providing additional care and that there was upsides to that. In 2007, the bill then was reauthorized, and the sunset was put aside. The current bill, this amendment, would expand to 180 days instead of the 90 days that was set in 2003, and would actually, as far from the original statute and situation back in the 70s and the 80s. So we're not asking to go back as full providers without any time limits, but we are asking to go back to at least 180 days. As I mentioned, and you've heard, this is a small issue It's roughly 6/100ths or 5/100ths of the total billings in the workers' comp system. But as you'll hear from Teresa Russell, a nurse practitioner who practices in rural Oregon, it's very important to not just rural, but let me also address access in urban areas. There are access issues in urban areas as well. It's not just the travel. It's the ability to see or schedule to get in to see a doc when you're referred. Sometimes it takes weeks, months. You may not be able to get in to see a doc. A doc may not want to see you. And if a doc does want to see you, it would add additional cost to the system because I'm not aware of any physicians that are going to take a referred case to them without them doing a full workup and have adding additional cost to the system. As you've heard, the MLAC vote was split. There was discussions going back and forth. I'm not sure that the final vote that came out was totally indicative of what the support was by either the labor side or the management side. But in the end, it failed in MLAC. And with that, I'll let Teresa Russell tell her story.
Before you do, you mentioned that 90 days was arbitrary. Why 180? Or is that just another arbitrary time?
Mr. Chair, it is. But what we've found over the years since the 90 days, actually since the 30 days was put in, what percentage of those cases extend beyond 90 days? And as I mentioned before, the total number of billings or the amount of billings for nurse practitioners is very small. The number of cases that go beyond 90 days is also very small. But in many cases, what you're really talking about, the cases that go on beyond 90 days, are just a matter of somebody still being in rehab, going to a physical therapist, the report's coming back to the nurse practitioner to close the case out. It may be very minimal treatment beyond the 90 days. So we are talking about a small portion of a small portion of the total workers' comp system. But 90 days was arbitrary, I would guess, from the numbers I've seen, that probably 90% of the cases get closed within 90 days. But there are some cases that go beyond 90 days. And there is no reason, if it's within the scope and practice of a nurse practitioner, and it's just a matter of getting the report back from physical therapist or closing the case out, that they shouldn't be able to go beyond the 90 days.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2092 and the -2 Amendment. For the record, my name is Teresa Russell, and I'm a nurse practitioner in Enterprise, Oregon. I live in Joseph. My clinic is in Enterprise. House Bill 2092 and the -2 Amendment would extend the time that nurse practitioners can treat a patient for workers' compensation from 90 days to 180 days. I wasn't aware of the entire history, and so that was all. I've always wondered why 90 days. I've been practicing for 13 years, and I can give you a lot of stories. I have my own clinic, Olive Branch Family Health Incorporated. It's new. We've been open 6 months. I have electronic health records, and they tell me that I have about 700 patients in my practice now. So you can see nurse practitioners in rural communities do serve the community and are needed. I'm in a solo practice. I have an independent pharmacy housed under the same roof, and it is run by Bob and Sue Coulter out of LeGrand. I like to point out that nurse practitioners in Oregon can practice independently and provide comprehensive care. Our scope of practice includes illness and disease, also injuries, prescribing, dispensing medications, and we practice without the supervision of a physician. In my experience, it's pretty obvious when a patient comes in with a work comp whether I'm going to be able to manage that patient or if I have to refer them. If I have to refer them, it's usually done right away, and it's usually not to an NP in my community. It's usually to a specialist outside the community somewhere. So a few things that could maybe complicate that care. The instance I put here was one that will always haunt me. It was a lady who came in with a back injury. She was I stabilized her, treated her, and she just didn't get better. She ended up being referred for surgery. The surgeon thought he could take care of it. She was just one of those people. It didn't come together very well. So we ended up with chronic pain management, which I could do, was doing very well. 90 days came in, and I got a letter from Safe Corporation saying that they would no longer pay me to take care of her. So I referred her to one of the physicians in my practice, and he was like, why? You're doing a great job. He didn't know her. He resented it. I resented it. The patient resented it. And it just didn't fit our case. Everything was fine. It was status quo. That's where we got caught in this law. We have, for 7,200 people, 8 providers. We're pretty lucky, but if any of you know where Wallowa County is, it's like a high mountain village. It's very spread out. There's a series of small towns. Once you leave I-84 Interstate at LeGrand, 20 miles to Elgin, they have 2 clinics there, and they have struggled to keep a clinic there. One is run by a nurse practitioner, one by a PA. 60 more miles down the road, you get to Enterprise, and it's the only place you can get health care in Wallowa County. We have very remote areas in Naha, lots of ranchers, lots of construction people, Forest Service. I actually worked at a clinic in Halfway, which makes Enterprise look like Salem in comparison. You never know what's going to come in your door and what you've got to be prepared to either stabilize, take care of, or ship to Baker City, which is a very rough drive. So it's not easy. And my patients will tell you they're very happy with the care. They come to me because they trust me, they know me, and they expect a certain quality of service from me. So limiting the time that a nurse practitioner can treat a workers' comp patient, in addition to interrupting that continuity of care, can pose a significant challenge for the patient who has to see a physician out of the county or somewhere else. The travel, it's very difficult. So I have a lot I can say. I want to thank you for letting me testify, and I urge you to support House Bill 2092 with the -2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Witt was hoping to come and testify on the -2s. I think he's stuck in committee, so I just wanted to let you know that he has an interest in this bill.
Thank you. Questions, Brian or Teresa? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2092? 2092. Dyslexic today. Every day. If hearing that, we will close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 2092. I'm going to move the -2 amendments. I understand and generally always support MLAC, but this one looks to me like it expands service care to people, particularly in rural areas, and that's important. I understand your desire to look at the broader issues, and I guess this doesn't keep you from doing that. So I think... So with that, the chair moves the -2s, and we'll see where we're at. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair, I have to say that I'm a understanding, I think, of some of the issues, but I have to say that I'm concerned that we're moving the amendment outside of the MLAC process. That seems to be a process that, for the most part, has worked and helped legislators kind of gauge some of these things. So I don't know. I'm just concerned a bit concerned about it.
I understand that. Others? Senator Burdick?
I usually and I definitely support the work of the MLAC group, but I feel like the proponents on this have made a strong case, and I don't think there's anything in this bill that that cuts MLAC out of further discussion on this issue. And if the 180 days turns out to be a problem of some sort that we haven't seen before, I would hope and expect that MLAC would come back and with a reasoned argument for some different number. So I will be supporting the amendment.
Any other comments? Let's call the roll, Carolyn.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Broad?
Aye. Senator excused.
Need 4.
Need 4, yeah.
committee?
Yes.
Here he is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll vote no.
Yes.
Aye. I believe that's four, so the dash twos are adopted. The chair now moves House Bill 2092 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a do pass. Let's call the roll again, Carolyn.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator
Burrard?
Senator Starr?
I'm going to support the committee and vote yes, but I'm going to look at it. I won't commit to a yes vote on the floor, but I'll vote yes to get it out of the committee.
Mr. Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair
Byers? Aye. House Bill 2092, as amended by the dash twos, is passed to the floor. The due pass recommendation, Chair will carry. And John, please express to the full room, this is not in any way a vote of lack of trust, lack of confidence in MLAC. I think you stated some good reasons, and I hope you do go forward and look at all of that. And again, if it means some changes, please bring them back. Like the work that MLAC does, this one just seems like something that's going to lower costs rather than raise costs, and I know that that's jointly something that we're all about. So thank you. So we will close the work session on House Bill 2092 and... Let's see. We need to... I think there are a lot of people... Well, let's do the next one. We'll open public hearing on House Bill 2093. Richard?
Senate Bill 2093 limits the services of managed care services for injured workers to certified managed care organizations. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact.
John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of HB 2093A. Managed care in workers' compensation was established in Oregon in 1990, and its purpose is to help curb medical costs while ensuring workers have access to quality medical services. And we just had a conversation about access, and it is one of the best ways that we can ensure workers do have access to care when they're enrolled in a managed care organization. About 40% of disabled injured workers are enrolled in managed care organizations. In Oregon, a managed care organization must be certified by the department, and they have to meet certain standards. For example, managed care organizations must notify workers about their rights to be able to choose their attending physician within the MCO panel, to provide a process for dispute resolution for both injured workers as well as panel providers, ensure workers have access to medical providers for their treatment, and to conduct medical peer review to ensure high-quality care. Injured workers in Oregon have the right to choose any medical provider for their care. Managed care organizations may limit enrolled workers' access to certain providers that are part of their panel, and they may direct workers as the MCO contract determines is necessary. But those restrictions are offset by the protections that are provided through the regulatory requirements managed care organizations must meet. At the department, we do receive complaints about organizations that are not certified managed care organizations who are engaged in directing injured worker care by interfering with appointments, directing workers to providers the worker doesn't choose, and delaying medical treatment. This is against the law. The activity harms both injured workers and medical providers as well as employers. It disrupts established patient-provider relationships that are based on familiarity and trust. It interferes with the worker's treatment as well as disrupting a provider's treatment plan. The patient, employer, and providers don't receive the critical protections and benefits provided by Oregon's managed care law under those circumstances. The current law allows the department to regulate and penalize only certified managed care organizations. If we find a company is managing injured workers' care without certification, the only way we may address that behavior is to take action through the state's court system, and that can be costly and a slow process. This bill would give us, the DCBS, the ability to take administrative action against a person or a company that's actively managing the care of workers without being certified under the law. We'd be able to impose civil penalties and issue cease and desist orders when necessary to stop improper behavior. The bill would also provide a process for the person or company to appeal any sort of action like that. The bill may, and I think should, encourage some companies that are engaged in managed care activities without certification to become certified as managed care organizations to comply with the law here in Oregon. MLAC has voted to support this bill in its engrossed form, and I just say thank you, and I'd be happy to answer your questions on this bill.
Thank you. Questions or John on this one? Seeing none, don't move. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? I have nobody else signed up. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2094. Chair moves House Bill 20...
We're on 2093.
I'm looking at the wrong one. We're actually on 2093. 2093, right? That's what I said. There's a lot of them in the way. Clarify. Chair moves House Bill 2093A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on a motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 2093A is approved. Moved to the House to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. And let's see, Senator Atkinson, would you carry this one?
Giddy up.
Giddy up, he's got it. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2094. Richard. That
wasn't there. Senate Bill 2094 authorizes a delay in a reconsideration proceeding for notice of claim closure in a workers' compensation claim under certain circumstances. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
How about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Again, I'm here to testify in support of 2094A. Workers' compensation disputes can be costly. They can be adversarial. DCBS promotes the use of alternative dispute resolution. That includes negotiating settlements. And negotiating settlements outside of formal administrative review or hearings can help workers receive benefits more quickly, reduce future litigation, avoid expensive medical examinations, make more efficient use of government resources, and generally it leaves both parties feeling satisfied with the result rather than one party feeling like they were the winner and one party feeling like they were the loser. Reconsideration is a term that we use. It's one of the administrative review processes in which alternative dispute resolution is beneficial. Reconsideration occurs when a worker, insurer, or self-insured employer appeals the notice of claim closure. A worker receives a notice of claim closure when their medical condition is stable and is not expected to improve. This notice closes the claim, and it establishes the amount of disability benefits the worker may receive as a result of their injury. When the notice is appealed to the department, we have a very short time frame for the initial resolution of that appeal. Once DCBS receives a request for appeal or reconsideration, we have 18 working days to make a decision to issue an order. 60 more days are allowed if more information is needed, and that's almost always when a physician needs to examine the worker to help resolve the dispute. These time frames are too short for parties to complete settlement. The bill would allow a delay of the reconsideration process for up to 45 days when the parties are actively engaged in settlement negotiations that include reconsideration issues and both parties agree to the delay process. If either party changes their mind during any time in that deferral period, they can request that the reconsideration process resume. If both parties fail to reach a settlement on reconsideration issues, the process will restart at the end of the deferral period of 45 days, and DCBS will complete the reconsideration process as usual. The bill also provides that any permanent disability benefits already awarded to the worker in their notice of closure, would continue during the settlement negotiations as currently happens during the reconsideration process. Again, AMLAC has voted to support this bill in its engrossed form, and again, thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, or John? Seeing none. We will, let's see, close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2094. Chair moves House Bill 2094A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, House Bill 2094A is passed by unanimous motion to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Starr, would you carry this?
Sure.
Okay, Senator Starr will carry. We'll close on that, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2347.
Richard. Senate Bill 2347 excludes officiating services at amateur sporting events from the definition of employment for the purpose of unemployment insurance taxation. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a revenue statement issued and a fiscal statement issued, but there's no recommendation to move this to Ways and Means.
Thank you. We have a long list here, it looks like. Tom Weber and Jack Folkart, is that right? Did I get close?
Close.
Okay.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify this afternoon in support of House Bill 2347. I'm Tom Welter. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon School Activities Association. And with me is Jack Folliard, who is the Executive Director of our Oregon Athletic Coaches or Oregon Athletic Officials Association. The OSA was formed in 1918, and we conduct high school activities for 288 member schools across the state of Oregon. Each year, we conduct 119 different state championships in 19 different activities, and approximately 120,000 students in our member high schools participate in one of the activities that we sponsor. We couldn't conduct all the activities we do without having amateur sports officials to officiate many of the contests that we sponsor. And our amateur officials are truly that. They're not professionals. They come from all walks of life. It might be a 19-year-old freshman at a community college or a college trying to make some extra money to get through school. It goes all the way up to recently, Oregon Supreme Court Judge Mick Gillette was one of our basketball officials for a number of years and won some of our state tournaments in that capacity. But they come from all walks of life. They do their jobs during the day, and they commit to helping out high school kids at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and get to go out and stand in the rain and umpire baseball games. So we would appreciate your support of House Bill 2347. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Folliard.
Thank you. I'm Jack Folliard, and as Mr. Welter said, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Athletic Officials Association, and privilege and honor to testify before you in support of this particular bill. I'm also a basketball referee in the state for high school and a college football official, so I'm kind of here to answer any questions you may have with respect to how the system really works at the grassroots level. We have about 3,500 amateur sports officials that work football, volleyball, soccer, all the high school sports. And as Mr. Welter indicated, it's basically a labor of love for us. It's a hobby. We don't get paid a lot. We're responsible for our own uniforms, rule books, travel, mileage expense, and all of the expenses that we have. The very essence, as you know, of officiating is independency. The money comes from the schools. They pay for the officials, and we're organized in about 115 what we call local associations. For example, the Salem Volleyball Officials Associations, or the Blue Mountain, which is in Pendleton, Soccer Officials Association. And it's just a bunch of officials that need to provide the services, ranging from maybe 10 officials in an association up to maybe over 300 in the Portland associations. The schools pay for the services by sending the monies to the association. The association, we train, we go out and do our games, and the association then pays us our game fees. It's a straight pass-through arrangement. So, we sort of hold the monies in trust to pay for the officials. And so to consider officials employees for unemployment compensation of anybody kind of flies in the face of how the system works. So with that, I'm happy to entertain any questions that the committee may have on this subject.
Any questions, each gentleman? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
And I think, did you cover the amendment?
No, I didn't mention it.
Looks like we've got about six people who want to talk about an amendment. So let's see. I've got six, so let's call up Ray Miles, Darren Campbell, and A.P. Parks.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darren Campbell. I'm here today representing Radio Cab Company in Portland, Oregon. However, I'm also representing the taxi cab industry in Oregon as a whole. First off, let me say that that one of my hobbies is a volunteer football coach, and I'm actually on the board of a football league up in the Portland area. And the officials that we have are outstanding, typically young men and women that work very hard. We in no way want to interrupt the language of the legislation that's in front of you. We simply want to add to it. During the interim, we had a interim committee introduce Senate Bill 257, which did not get a hearing and failed to meet the deadlines to get that hearing. So what we're requesting is adding that language to this bill, and it's in regards to the taxicab industry working as they always have been as independent contractors and keeping them that way. It's a more of a clarification of current operating procedure that we have right now. I would like to turn it over to Ray Miles, who is the president of Broadway Cab in Portland.
Good afternoon. My name is Ray Miles. I'm the president of Broadway Cab in Portland. I'm also the president of the Oregon Alliance for the Preservation of Community Transportation. And I just really want to urge you to consider amending this bill. These amendments are critical to our industry. We aren't asking to change anything. We're really asking to preserve the way the industry's run for 80 years since Broadway has been in business. It's also consistent with the way the industry operates across the United States. And I just urge you to consider these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman, Senators, my name is Andrew Parks. I represent Oregon Taxi, which is the largest provider of taxi service in Lane County. These amendments are very crucial to the continuing operation of Oregon Taxi's business. And Mr. Charles Hare, who's one of the owners in Oregon Taxi's here, he can tell you about that a little bit better than I can as to what the actual impact could potentially be for crucial services to folks in Lane County. But I would, from a legal standpoint, I would simply point out that all we're seeking here through this amendment is a clarification of the existing status of these drivers as independent contractors. From a workers' compensation standpoint, they are already regarded as independent contractors as a result of a bill passed in the last legislative session. So by passing the amendments that are requested to 2347, it really brings the law in line and consistent across the board as to how these folks are treated. Thank you.
Questions of this panel?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Starr?
What's precipitated the need to, if this is the way the industry's always worked for the last 80 years, why all of a sudden do we need to have a bill to allow the industry to continue to operate this way it's operated for the last 80 years?
Recently, Broadway and other taxicab companies in Oregon have been audited by the Employment Department. It's something Broadway has been through before. And you know, the Employment Department has reached a finding that the drivers are employees, not independent contractors. We've been through it before. We will appeal this finding. We're confident we'll win on appeal, but it will cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. And, you know, I guess we're just hoping to create some fix that doesn't cost the industry this kind of money.
Senator Starr, if I could further address that question. Oregon Taxi similarly has faced audits from the Employment Department. They've been through one as already and one assessment and a contested case hearing. There's another one now pending. Selfishly, you know, that's what keeps me in business, but it's not a good solution for my client, nor is it a good solution for the state to have to dedicate resources to basically ultimately having the court of appeals decide this issue when we've got all these other conflicting areas of the law that suggest that drivers are in fact independent contractors, i.e. the workers' compensation arena. So those expenditures could be saved not only for private industry, but for the state as well at the Department of Justice level, in the event that the committee sees fit to consider these amendments and pass them on to the floor for further discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Can I respond to that as well? Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the radio cab is also under the same audits right now. We find out our fate on May 9th. One of the things that we're looking at is if we have these assessments that come through from the Employment Division and are required to pay a significant amount of money or fight it like Broadway is doing now, that's going to significantly increase our costs as a cab company to the lease drivers who lease cabs on a daily basis. And, you know, there's going to be a trickle-down theory there where our contracts with the VA, Broadway has TriMet. Those contracts are going to go up in price. Portland Public Schools is a big contract for us. Lane County School District, 4J School District is a big one for Oregon Taxi. All those costs are going to go up, and it's going to end up costing everybody we serve, as well as the contractors who lease cabs from these companies, a great deal of money, to the point where I would fear that there would be several drivers that wouldn't be able to make it doing it at the higher cost.
Mr. Chair, so the situation is one where you had a independent contractor who, for whatever reason, was decided to do something else, or there wasn't enough work, filed an unemployment claim with the Employment Division. Is that what precipitated the audit?
We're not sure. There have been people who have claimed claimed for unemployment compensation, and they've always been denied. Historically, they've been denied those claims. This is a very recent, I don't really want to use the word attack on the industry, but movement by the Employment Division in the last year or two. And we've had a hard time getting answers out of the Employment Division as to where it all began.
Mr. Chair, the Employment Department is operating under some statutory authority. Can you point me to the statutory authority upon which they're coming after the taxi cab industry?
Chairman, Senator Starr, I believe the answer to that question lies in ORS Chapter 657. The precise statute, I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional, sir?
This amendment has absolutely nothing to do with the underlying content of the bill. Did you make any effort to reach out to the supporters of the bill to ask them whether it was okay to put this amendment in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we did drop off amendments to the Aussie Rose down in the Lobby Message Center. However, this kind of happened quickly. So I guess the best answer would be sort of.
Well, the amendment is dated April 6th, and when I talked to Mr. Rose yesterday, he had heard nothing of it.
I think that, Charlie, do you want that?
We just had no idea whether we would go ahead with it or not until today.
Say his name for the record. Could you put your name on the record, Charlie?
Sorry. Charles Williamson, I'm an attorney from Portland. We had this drafted, actually, with Senator Burdick's cooperation, but we had other options we were exploring, and did not know if there'd be any possibility of having this committee consider it until this morning. So we did not talk to the other folks, and we seriously do not want to impair their bill. We'd like to see their bill passed, and we just would like to hitch a ride on it.
Other questions?
No, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I just I've done this before with things that were important to me, and I've always it's been my first stop, not my last stop, to see whether the sponsor of the underlying bill was comfortable having that happen. And I don't think this is the right way to do things.
While you're there, Ms. Williamson, thank you. And I've got Charlie. And let's see who else is here. Red Diamond, and let's see, Charlie, what is it?
Charles Hare.
I'm sorry.
Could I stay up here and give my testimony, yep. Sir?
Excuse me?
Could I stay and give my testimony?
I hope you would.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, who would you like to go first?
Whoever.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you for taking some time to hear me this afternoon. My name is Charles Hare. I'm the owner of Oregon Taxi, based in Eugene, Oregon, which I'm sure a few of you are familiar with our cars. We're the largest taxi provider in Lane County, and this bill is crucial to the survival of all taxi companies in Lane County. My company provides in excess of 100,000 runs a year to the elderly and disabled through RideSource, to children, through 4J, to several intoxicated people, keeping them off the roads at night, keeping the streets safer, students at the University of Oregon, and out-of-state visitors who enter via the Eugene Airport. The financial impact of the continued audits which my company has faced from assessments and the Employment Department and legal fees of what I've had to pay thus far is making it very difficult for my company to be profitable. Amendments proposed would simply clarify the driver's status as independent contractors, which they overwhelmingly support, both the drivers for Oregon Taxi as well as the ownership. And I would just like to make this consistent with currently what's happening with workers' compensation.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee. My name is Red Diamond. I am the elected taxi driver's representative from Portland. Drivers in Portland face a number of important issues for which our industry is poised to make serious reforms. However, the reforms that we are seeking in Portland are essentially local issues with regards to the state legislature. And this particular issue, our preference by far is to maintain the status quo. We are, by and large, a very independent people. As cab drivers, we enjoy our freedom and our mobility, whether it's something as mundane as simply choosing when and where we'll take lunch, or whether it's something more important regarding where and when we will seek economic opportunities. I've been a cab driver as the primary means of my livelihood for 18 years. I've worked in two cities for five different companies, and I have always been an independent contractor. I've always been self-employed. As you know, this situation was recently challenged by the Employment Department's ruling that we would be regarded as employees. There may be individual circumstances in which a company and the employees and the workers would prefer to organize themselves in that manner. Generally, that would be a small town and a small company. But that is quite a different thing from a state-mandated ruling that would require all workers in our industry to be employees. By far, it is the preference of the taxi drivers in Portland that we maintain the status quo as independent contractors and as self-employed people. And therefore, the taxi companies in Portland and the drivers are united in opposing the employment department's ruling. Right now, the company I drive for, Broadway Cab, has perhaps about 2 or 3 dozen employees. If this ruling went through, it would change the structure of our organization to having about 400 employees. You can imagine the types of revisions this would require within our industry. It would be very expensive to implement these changes, and the burden of that would largely be brought by, would be borne by the drivers and ultimately by the riding public, as it would diminish our efficiencies. It's important to bear in mind that in Portland we have a closed and regulated market. There are only 6 taxi companies. There are 382 taxi permits, and there are about 1,000 drivers. If you envision a free market system where you have 1,000 individuals competing for business, and you reduce that from 1,000 to 6 companies, you can imagine the types of inefficiencies that would result in less productivity among the workers and less service among the riding public. And so I encourage you all to lend your support to the Senate bill at 257 as an amendment to 2347.
So, sir, what company do you drive for?
I drive for Broadway Cab.
And do you own the car?
No, I lease the car.
Who do you lease the car from?
From the company itself.
Charlie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I just want to point out we did have some amendments drafted to Senate Bill 257 at the behest of the Employment Division to make sure there was no technical problems with it, and those amendments are included in the proposed amendments to 2347. The Employment Division was very kind in working with us on getting those amendments done. I passed out a letter from the Teamsters. The Teamsters do represent the non-driver employees of both Broadway and Radio, and they support SB 257. And then, I guess, lastly, we did submit numerous signatures on petitions from the drivers. Red Diamond is the elected representative of 1,000 drivers in Portland. The drivers overwhelmingly, they want to, you know, when they collect a fare, they want that fare to be theirs, not the company's. They can take the dispatch service or not take the dispatch service. They can go to their kid's soccer game in the middle of the afternoon if it's slow. They don't have to take any, do anything. They have city business licenses. They are not at all controlled by the company. They can take the cab and go park in their driveway and go to sleep. So that they truly are independent contractors, and it is a shame that both the companies and the state would be subjected to this substantial number of lawsuits, and then even if we lose a lawsuit, there may be changes. We truly do not have a good explanation from the Employment Division as to exactly why they are making the rulings that they're making. One of the reasons we've been waiting here and not going to the proponents of this bill is we talked to Representative Schaffler last week about perhaps amending another bill, and he called the Employment Division and said, hey, I want you to give me a letter. I want to see why. You know, you've got a company that's gone 80 years without, you know, as independent contractors, and now you're auditing them and seeing their employees, and he hasn't got a letter yet explaining. So we don't know. We don't know what it is. And if we do know, maybe we could change it. But we are really stuck. I mean, it's going to be a very expensive, long time consuming slog for the companies and the department if we can't get this resolved here. Thank you very much.
That's the only names I have. Go ahead.
I'd also like to add, and I know Ray Miles had mentioned it, and Darren also mentioned it. The costs that are associated with this, if we can't get a place for this, ultimately are going to come back to the consumer. And it's unfortunate that the majority of the people who ride with us either can't afford a vehicle or are elderly on a fixed income. And I certainly want to make this affordable and keep things going the way that they've been going for the past 80 years. And I hope you'll find a place for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Mr. Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. On the original bill, 2347, we're neutral. You know, the amateur sports officials, although this particular group that testified, they have over 3,000 folks that are involved, they are independent contractors, we think, under the definition that the Employment Department uses. And the bill, we think, is narrow, very narrow. It doesn't affect very many folks. The sports officials we're talking about are part-time. And so we think that's correct. As far as the cab drivers go, it's not that easy of an issue at all. I mean, for us, we definitely would not support this bill if the cab drivers were included, much like Senate Bill 257 that I've talked with some of you about before. When it comes to the drivers and the companies in Portland, they're not all united. There are a couple of hundred drivers that are working with one of our unions in Portland that are attempting to take their group and form into a co-op, so they will be able to get some kind of benefits or plan for some kind of benefits. When you're talking about unemployment insurance and the definition that's in statute, it's a definition that this body debated. This body put together a 2005 interim committee to look at the definition of independent contractors, and out of that advisory committee came a piece of legislation that passed on both sides of this chamber overwhelmingly and tweaked in 2007 the definition of independent contractor. Didn't change it a lot. It tweaked it, clarified it a little bit at the time. And the test that's applied to cab drivers or anybody else is a situation that comes up when all of a sudden they're unemployed. The economy goes down, cab drivers are unemployed, they're actually laid off, the work's not there for them, and the Employment Department gets a claim. They take a look at it. They apply the test. And in over 20 claims, the Employment Department ruled in every single claim applying the test that these folks fall under the independent contractor test. They are employees under the independent contractor test, not independent contractors. The companies may want them to be independent contractors. They may lease their cab from the company or own their cab outright or whatever, but when it comes to the test of direction and control, they're employees. And because of that, the companies then are obligated to pay unemployment insurance taxes like the other companies in the state pay as well. We support that, and it's part of doing business. And I understand that for years they wanted to be independent contractors, but under the statute, that's not the case. They're employees. We're talking about cab drivers that in Portland really, you know, many. I mean, these folks aren't getting rich. They're working hard. It's hard work, and many of them have to pay a weekly fee to the company to get their fares. That's over $500 a week. You know, besides leasing their vehicle, paying those kind of fare, paying the company to get their fares. And I think that, you know, we're just looking at these folks, you know, as employees like the rest of the folks in the state. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Steve.
Yes.
Is there anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2743 and open the work session on House Bill 2743. 2347. I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong one. Anybody choose to move the amendment? Seeing none, the chair then will move House Bill 2347 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the bill.
The bill should pass.
Is there any opposition? Seeing none, House Bill 2347 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Edwards, would you like to carry this one?
Would be happy to.
Is there anything else to come before the body?
There's not.
We are adjourned.